From Peoria Public Radio, this is Out and About. I'm Nathan Irwin.
And I'm Jen Gordon with Arts Partners of Central Illinois. Today we're talking with Chip Joyce. He's directing Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson at the Cornstalk Winter Playhouse. Chip, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks. I think this is my first time here with you, Jen.
Well, it's so great to have you back.
Thank you.
So set the stage for the show. This is a rock musical that follows the life of the 7th president. What light does it paint Andrew Jackson in?
Okay. Well, yeah, Andrew Jackson in a rock musical, it's an obvious choice, right? you know, I'll spare the history lesson. Of course, he's the 7th president, responsible for the Trail of Tears, you know, uprooting lots of Indian tribes, particularly in the southeast, pushed them westward. Basically said, you know, I want the South. It's ours. You have to go, you know, comply or suffer the consequences, basically. I've told people, you know, it's an emo rock musical. If you don't know what emo rock is, it's kind of splintered off from, like, punk rock. It's much more sensitive lyrics. It's just kind of a hypersensitive form of punk music. Bands like Dashboard Confessional and bands like that are considered emo rock bands. And people said that, you know, why juxtaposing emo rock with Andrew Jackson? And based on what I've read and kind of my thoughts on it is, you know, let's say the United States is, what, 240 years old now, give or take. Andrew Jackson's reign, you know, his presidency and when he was the first governor of Florida took place about 40 to 50 years after, you know, the United States became a nation. So you could look at it as the United States was essentially a teenager in those years. And, you know, teenagers are moody and their emotions are extreme highs and lows and they're prone to temper tantrums and just kind of always being angry at the world. And that's kind of how the political climate was. You know, the United States at that point was essentially a one-party system. A room full of elite gentlemen were essentially choosing our leaders, and Andrew Jackson didn't like that, and he wanted to shake things up, and he founded the Democratic Party. And lo and behold, that's a large part of the story behind Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, in addition to his, you know, for as brutish and as hard-headed a guy as he was, he actually had his Achilles heel kind of was his wife, Rachel, who was married to another man when they met, and, I mean, you know, 200 some years ago, divorce was even kind of an odd topic, but they actually married while she was still technically married to her first husband. So she was a bigamist, and that was kind of the big skeleton in their closet as he rose to power and that they struggled with. And she actually, Rachel died in the time after he was elected, but before he took office. She died in December of, I want to say 1828. I might be off a date or so. I don't have the notes in front of me. So by the time he became president, you know, he was a widower. And they say, and they even kind of make light of this in the show, that, she, you know, she couldn't take the pressure and the scrutiny that was thrust on them, especially about her past, and that's what killed her, you know, as kind of melodramatic as that sounds. But I visited the Hermitage, Andrew Jackson's plantation, over Labor Day weekend. We were down in Nashville for a wedding and took a little side trip, and that's where they're buried, essentially out in the yard behind the Hermitage, behind the big Southern plantation mansion.
So how did you come to discover this musical, and what was it about the show that made you want to stage it?
The show is, you know, it had kind of a gestation period of about 2 or 3 years. It's a show that was put together in California and then moved to New York. Benjamin Walker, who is an actor. He's actually, I believe, Meryl Streep's son-in-law, but he played Andrew Jackson, and not too well known in Hollywood, but probably his best film credit to date is that he played Abraham Lincoln in Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. So I think he's kind of cornered the market on alternate takes on presidents. But the show moved to New York in about 2010. It played at the Public Theater, which is one of the more prolific off-Broadway houses. They are responsible for the world premiere of Hair back in the 60s. In fact, Hair might have been one of the first productions they staged. A Chorus Line debuted there. And another political musical that nobody has heard of called Hamilton also premiered there about 2 or so years ago. It then moved to Broadway, like I said, in about 2010, 2011. Its run on Broadway was very short. It was very successful at the Public. It was one of their highest grossing shows of all time. Tremendous buzz around it, and then it got to Broadway, and I think Broadway realized that, you know, or they realized it was a little too small and a little too much of a niche show for Broadway audiences. And, you know, we kind of, I think here in Central Illinois, think Broadway is this place where anything goes, you know, in terms of content and, you know, how things are portrayed. But I mean, New York, probably more than anywhere else, it's important that their shows make money and they play to the tourists and, you know, the rich old couples that come in from Jersey that want to see. That's why shows like Mamma Mia will run for, you know, 10 to 15 years. Phantom, you know, the spectacle of Phantom of the Opera, I think it's been running 30 years now. Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson lasted for about 90 days on Broadway.
So Chip, talk a little bit more about presenting it here in Central Illinois. The performances take place at the Winter Playhouse, and this really is a venue that allows a director the creative liberty to stage a show that's maybe a little bit more edgy.
Yes. Well, like I was just saying about, you know, it had kind of a short run in New York because it just was too small for Broadway. You would never see Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson at Cornstalk's Tent in the summer because there's no way a show like this in Peoria could honestly sell, you know, 500 seats over 9 nights. But we're hopeful and we're optimistic that we can sell about 150 seats over 6 nights, you know, which is, you know, a success at the Winter Playhouse. But yes, I love the space. And when I first heard about Bloody Bloody, you know, it was kind of on my radar, you know, back when it was playing Broadway, because I knew that Andrew Jackson, you know, there hadn't been a president like him, you know, just kind of almost mildly insane. What I knew of him prior to doing the show and kind of delving into it, it almost seemed like, you know, 200 years ago, electing someone like Gary Busey president. But yeah, the space is unique. And I always knew that, you know, if this show ever comes to Peoria, it'll be a lab show for sure. It did play at Eureka College a few years ago, and that's another great space for it. Of course, you know, I kind of feel like its community theater life is very limited. But, you know, colleges and small playhouses like the Cornstalk's Lab Winter Playhouse are exactly suited for it. We've got it's done in the full round. We do have a live rock band on stage. And if I can brag for a moment, we have a 5-piece rock band. Sometimes we have as many as 3 or 4 guitars playing at one time on stage, full drum kit. But I have not gotten one complaint about the sound in there, which has been awesome. So that's been really great. And it's a jam-packed 90 minutes. It's a very short show, no intermission. It's a jam-packed 90 minutes. It's like going to a rock concert that tells a story. People, you know, when we announce the show, inevitably we're saying, is it like Hamilton? And I suppose on paper, you know, if you were to say, well, we're using modern music and language to tell the story of, you know, this American historical figure, sure, that's how it's like Hamilton. If anyone saw American Idiot, you know, either on Broadway or when it played here at the Civic Center a few years ago. I know I did. It's much more like that show. I would say it's kind of a cross between American Idiot and Hamilton, even though it's actually a couple years older than either of those shows.
You talked about the decision to put the band on the stage in the performance space, and in the Winter Playhouse, space comes at a premium. There's not a lot of it. So how does that change the dynamic of the performance? What opportunities does that create? I mean, what does that add to the performance?
What's really neat, there's been, you know, a few years ago, you know, when technology allowed you to have pre-recorded music or electronic music, it came out and it was kind of a neat new toy and people were kind of intrigued to use it because it was a new thing. But ultimately, I think live musicians have held up and you're seeing fake music, if you will, used far less in shows. You know, it's a corner cutting measure. And I think if you really want genuine quality brought to your production, you know, you use live music. And this show, it's really neat. It fuses the band and the actors together in a way that you don't see in a lot of shows. And you couldn't not have the band on stage because the band interacts with the actors. At times, actors will perform in scenes and dance numbers. The actors themselves pick up guitars and play on several numbers. You almost can't tell where the band ends and the cast begins. And that's not something you see a lot of around here. And once I realized I had the resources, you know, the musicians that we did and the actors that we did that could play music, you know, anytime I have auditions, I always ask on the audition form, you know, to actors, do you play a musical instrument? And if I get the right answers, then I try and work that into the show somehow. I've done it a number of times, and I think this is kind of the ultimate version of that now.
And I should point out that you've been working with your band since very early in the rehearsal process. A lot of times you'll rehearse the show and then the orchestra comes in the last week or two.
Mm-hmm.
But you've had a lot of your musicians in your rehearsals since maybe not day one, but day three, let's say.
Yeah, yeah. We put the show together pretty quickly, a lot quicker than I normally would a musical. But Laura Weaver Hughes is my music director. She's worked with me a lot on keyboards. And Jimmy LaHood, who's my best friend, is our band leader, who's sort of a character in the show. He's a pseudo-narrator. He sings. He plays. We have another guitarist, David Lavallee, and John Spinder on bass, and Logan Mikesell on drums. And they have been there a lot longer than you would normally have a band for a show. Usually the band will kind of prepare apart from the cast, and then everybody comes together, usually Tech Sunday. But because we had actors performing, you know, in certain songs with them on guitar and things, and because the musicians themselves had to know a little bit more of what was going on than just the score to the show, and that they were going to kind of be involved and be essentially characters in the show or an extension of the cast, it was going to require a little bit more time on their part. And it happened, and it was great. And I think they've enjoyed it because it's a little bit different apart from, you know, being kind of hidden in a shoebox backstage and having your sound pumped in. But to be a part of the experience where the audience can see what you're doing, it's one of the best commercials for having live music you could hope for. You know, this is, you see them, and this is why live music is better than hitting play on a sound system.
And you said the show originally came out around 2009.
Yeah, right. 2010.
2010. So it was a different political landscape. It had limited success on Broadway, and now, regardless of what side of the fence you're on, we just see a lot of people tapping into a lot of emotions when it comes to politics and maybe a lot of anger. Do you think that makes this particular show maybe have a little bit more interest or more resonance with audiences?
Well, yeah, like you said, the emotions and that kind of hair trigger sensitivity to the political landscape, which has probably never been more volatile, except for maybe when Jackson was elected. I don't know for sure, but there were a lot of jokes, you know, throughout the show because this show's a few years old and there's been so much happening now. There were, you know, we made a lot of jokes. Even I made a lot of jokes during the process. It was like, oh, it'd be hilarious if we said this or, you know, this. And you don't have to. the show, one of its strengths is it's holding up remarkably well. And we didn't really have to do a lot of that. The show speaks for itself, and you're going to come to those conclusions just because that's what's on everybody's mind so much now. It's not, you know, it is a bit raw. We've had a lot of people ask, you know, is it appropriate for kids? And I would say it is not appropriate for children. I would probably say a mature middle schooler would be fine with this show, and it's purely for language and violence. And if you don't think they're ready to know about kind of the dark side of American history, the stuff that they're probably not talking about a whole lot in 7th and 8th grade social studies. Mm-hmm. If you as a parent are not ready for them to hear about that, then maybe not. But if they're mature and certainly if they're high school aged, it's perfect for them. I think they might respond better to kind of learning about history. And this show takes a lot of creative liberties with, you know, the timeline of Jackson's life and things like that. But I say mission accomplished if they go see this show and it inspires them to go home and Google more about Andrew Jackson or anything that was happening during that time, you know, the War of 1812 or the Trail of Tears, you know, too. I mean, I'm ashamed to admit how old I was before I even knew what that was, you know. So I think it's better that people learn about things like that at an earlier age.
Mm-hmm. And you've said that the show is high octane. It keeps you going from start to finish. It's very intense. It's 90 minutes. I'm curious, are there any moments in the show that are maybe a little bit more tender or introspective that kind of calm down?
Yeah, there definitely are. It's so funny. Like I said, it's a very intense 90 minutes energy-wise. Mm-hmm. The first line in the show is Andrew Jackson just looks at the audience and says, "Are you ready?" Just real quietly. And, you know, the more I thought about it, it was like, whoa, that's an understatement. You know, I sure hope so. But there are those tender moments. There has to be. You know, if you're just assaulting the audience for 90 minutes, they're not going to respond. I went and saw the Lego Batman movie last weekend, and it was like, wow, I got to see this again because there was so much going on. And there are moments in the show where, and I've had audience members say, you know, I kind of want to come back and see because I feel like I didn't catch it all. And anyone who would want to see anything I do more than once is like the biggest compliment to me. So that's awesome. But there are those tender moments, particularly the scenes with Jackson and Rachel, his wife. You know, he kind of, you know, I mean, he's the toughest guy in any room he walks into. But then when he gets home to the Hermitage, he just, you know, just kind of crawls into her arms and crumbles. And you do see a moment at the end of, you know, it's history, so I'm not really spoiling much. You know, he's in the White House alone. You know, obviously Rachel is gone, and he just kind of has this moment of solitude. He's isolated everyone around him. People, you know, cohorts that he had a great relationship with, he's destroyed. You know, his wife is dead. And we just have this incredible moment where you just kind of sit and you kind of wonder, is he regretting all of his choices? Is he just kind of hit his emotional breaking point? You know, what is it? And I suppose that's up to the audience to decide. And our band leader, Jimmy, sings a song called Second Nature that essentially talks about, it's a very tender song, but the lyrics, you got to really listen to them, because it's talking about, you know, it's human second nature. If you see something, you want it and you take it. You know, we see a beautiful plot of land, and somebody sees it, decides they want it, so they build a strip mall. You know, they cut down the trees there and, you know, like I said, build a strip mall that you better hope the economy remains good or will be empty in a few years. And that's kind of what the song talks about, and I think that's a great moment in the show that I like a lot.
We've been talking with Chip Joyce, director of Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson at Cornstalk Theater. The production continues tonight through Sunday at the Winter Playhouse. Chip, thanks for being with us, and break a leg.
Thank you.
This Sunday at 6 p.m., you can enjoy the music of the Daryl Mondheith Trio performing with the Central Illinois Jazz Society. The performance takes place at the Landmark Recreation Center. The performance is free for students, and for more information, you can call 309-692-5330.
And the Bradley Jazz Festival is next Tuesday. It closes with a performance featuring the Bradley Groove Project, the Jazz Ensemble, and guest artist Tom Malone. He's probably best known for his years as musical director of the Saturday Night Live House Band. That concert is Tuesday night at 7:30 at the Dingledine Music Center.
Out and About is a production of Peoria Public Radio and Arts Partners of Central Illinois. Each week, we connect you to the arts community by talking with local arts leaders and performers.
Our producer is Sierra Doss. You can listen to an extended version of this interview by subscribing to our podcast at PeoriaPublicRadio.org. I'm Nathan Irwin, and this is Out and About.